Let's open our Bibles to Isaiah chapter number 47 and remind ourselves that these prophecies are being written down by Isaiah in the late 8th century BC for them to reach their full impact a couple of centuries later whenever Babylon is brought up under God's judgment at the hands of Cyrus the Great, the Persian, who will allow, at God's direction, any ethnic Israeli to go back to the Promised Land and rebuild the city of Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, and reestablish the presence of Israel in the Promised Land. And so Babylon is being warned long before they become an empire that they are going to come under God's judgment, and Cyrus will be the tool God will use to do that. This is all intended as proof that God is God, that nobody else can give such detailed prophecies ahead of time because they're pretenders, they're wannabes, they're frauds, they're fakes. The idols are man-made images, not God who exists from before time began. All right, so Isaiah chapter 47, we already did a few of these verses, but let's start at the beginning of the chapter to get our full context, where God calls down Babylon ahead of time that their judgment is coming because of their treatment of the Israelis. So chapter 47, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. So Babylon is like a queen. It's like a grand lady at its peak. And God says, no, you're going to end up becoming a slave. You're going to be treated as a servant. For you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind flour. Pull off your veil, strip off your robe, uncover your legs, pass through the rivers. So get busy with menial work. Your nakedness shall be uncovered and your disgrace shall be seen. I will take vengeance and I will spare no one. Our Redeemer, he who is of the hosts or over the armies, is his name. He is the Holy One of Israel. Then back to the comments to Babylon itself. Sit in silence and go in darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called the mistress of kingdoms. So you're not going to be in charge anymore. Your empire is forfeit. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. I gave them into your hand. Now that's a reference to the Babylonian exile that happened in 587 BC. That's when the city was taken and destroyed. The temple was destroyed, and the great big bunch of survivors go into exile. 70 years later, along comes Cyrus the Great, and he takes over the Babylonian Empire, and at God's direction, probably because he's shown these passages in very ancient documents, he declares that any ethnic Israeli living inside of his empire can go back to Israel and rebuild the temple. So I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. I gave them into your hand. So Babylon, I allowed you to take my people in exile. You showed them no mercy. On the aged, you made your yoke exceedingly heavy. You said, I shall be a mistress forever, so that you may not lay these things to heart or remember their end. So they, the Babylonians, thought they could do whatever they felt like. And they were, in some cases, pretty mean to the Israelis. And God says, now is going to come judgment at the hands of the Persians. Now therefore hear this, you lover of pleasures who sit securely, who say in your heart, I am, and yes, that's correct. God pictures the personification of Babylon, the empire, being like a woman claiming to be God. I am. And there is none besides me. I shall not sit as a widow or know the loss of children. So, doesn't think anything can ever happen. Well, these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood shall come upon you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries and the great power of your enchantments. So in spite of the fact that you're trying to tap into the spirit world to protect yourself, your kingdom, your empire is going to end suddenly. And it did. And we have that recorded in the book of Daniel, that they were actually having a big party. And then suddenly the city of Babylon is taken by the Medo-Persian forces. You felt secure in your wickedness. You said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge led you astray, and you said in your heart, I am, and there is none beside me. So they thought they were it. They were the climax of history, and they were wrong. Verse 11, but evil, that is bad stuff, shall come upon you, which you will not know how to charm away. Babylon was really big into what we would call witchcraft or occult procedures and practices, trying to tap into the spirit world. And God says, that's not going to do you any good when my judgment falls. Disaster shall fall upon you, from which you will not be able to atone. For which you will not be able to atone, and ruin shall come upon you suddenly, of which you know nothing. Stand fast in your enchantments and your many sorceries with which you've labored from your youth. Perhaps you may be able to succeed. Perhaps you may inspire terror. That's all tongue-in-cheek. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let them stand forth and save you. Those who divide the heavens, that is, the people who practice astrology. Who gaze at the stars, who at the new moons make known what shall be come upon you. So they're casting horoscopes. Well, behold, they are like stubble. The fire consumes them. So these people that think they can tap into the spirit world to save the Babylonian Empire, they're going to find out that they're just like the junk that's left over after harvest. Not good for anything except being burned up. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. No coal for warming oneself is this, no fire to sit before. Such to you as those with whom you've labored, who have done business with you from your youth, they wander about each in his own direction. There is no one to save you. So the Babylonian Empire is going to just implode, and there won't be any way of saving it. It'll be completely absorbed by the Medo-Persian Empire. Chapter 48. Hear this, O house of Jacob, who are called by the name of Israel, and who came from the waters of Judah, who swear by the name of He who is, and confess the God of Israel, but not in truth or right. For they call themselves after the holy city and stay themselves on the God of Israel. He who is over the armies or of the hosts is his name. So now God addresses through Isaiah the people living in Judah that think they will be protected just because they're in Judah. We learn later that toward the end of the Judean kingdom, they actually believed that because the temple was in their city, the city would never be taken. And because the Ark of the Covenant was in the temple, that the city could never be taken. And God tells them here, look, you're going through the motions, you've got this ritual, but that's not what's needed for a relationship. Verse 3, the former things I declared of old, they went out from my mouth and I announced them. And then suddenly I did them, and they came to pass. This whole big section of the book of Isaiah is all about the fact that God proves himself by prophecy, the precision of information given well before the events. Because I know that you are obstinate, and your neck is an iron sinew and your forehead brass. That is very stubborn. You're hard-headed. You're stiff-necked. I declared them to you from of old. Before they came to pass, I announced them to you, lest you should say, my idol did them. My carved image and my mental image commanded them. God already knew the con artistry of the priests and priestesses of the pagan idols, where they would claim when some big event happens, well, my God did that. And God's response is, look, unless you can tell them ahead of time that something's going to happen with precision, you are no God. You can't claim to have done something after the fact unless you've already entered into the record long before what's going to happen. So that's what the point of this section of Isaiah is, which is another reason why I get very frustrated with those that claim this section of Isaiah was written after the fact. And that's why there's such precision in it and why the name of Cyrus is here. God's point is Isaiah wrote this stuff down in the late 8th century, and then this stuff was being read in the time that the events were happening from ancient books. It was being read so that the people could understand God called this stuff long beforehand. Verse 6, you have heard, now see all this. And will you not declare it? From this time forth, I announce to you new things, hidden things that you have not known. They are created now, not long ago, before today. You've never heard of them, lest you should say, behold, I knew them. You have never heard, you have never known. From of old, your ear has not been opened, for I knew that you would surely deal treacherously and that from before birth you were called a rebel. So I'm doing all this ahead of time so that you can't stack the deck in your favor to fake it. Jesus, by the way, makes a similar point about prophecy when he talks to his apostles, where he says, I'm going to tell you things before they happen, so that when they do happen, you will know that I am. And he uses the divine phrase, so that when Jesus, for example, is arrested and betrayed by one of the apostles, and he's abused and then handed over to the Romans, and he gets crucified and resurrects on the third day, because of the fact that he predicted all of that stuff well before time, the apostles should be able to have faith that he was and is and will always be he who is salvation. All right, back to the text of Isaiah. For my name's sake, verse 9 says, I defer my anger. For the sake of my praise, I restrain it from you that I may not cut you off. And God tells the Israelis this on more than one occasion. You guys deserve me just dealing great judgment against you, but I'm not going to do it because I've made promises. I've made promises that I'm going to use the Israelis to bring about great light and salvation to all the peoples of the world. I promised Abraham, in your seed, Abraham, all the nations, all the ethnic groups of the earth are going to be blessed. So God says, it's for my name's sake, my reputation, that I'm not wiping you guys out like you deserve. Verse 10, behold, I've refined you, but not as silver. I have tried you in the furnace of affliction for my own sake. For my own sake I do it. For how should my name be profaned? My glory I will not give to another. So God says, I am going to bring judgment on Israel, but it's not going to be a complete wipeout, because that would violate the promises I've already made. Verse 12, listen to me, O Jacob and Israel, whom I called. I am he. I am the first and I am the last. And you should recognize that phrasing in the book of Revelation, when God is referred to as the first and the last, the beginning and the end. It's also related to the whole Alpha Omega thing, the first and last letter of the Greek alphabet. It is a poetic way of describing He who is, the God who has no beginning, has no end. Verse 13, my hand laid the foundation of the earth, my right hand spread out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand forth together. So He is the Creator. Goes all the way back to the book of Revelation, or book of Genesis, and then all the way forward to the book of Revelation. Assemble, all of you, and listen. Who among them has declared these things? So this is a challenge against the idols. Who among those idols made these claims that this was the way it was going to take place? He who is loves him, meaning Israel. He shall perform his purpose on Babylon, and his arm shall be against the Chaldeans. So they will be judged. Now, Isaiah is writing this stuff down before Babylon even dreamed of becoming an empire with great power. And so these documents will be very old by the time all that happens. I have spoken and called him. I've brought him, and he will prosper in his way. Draw near to me. Hear this. From the beginning, I have not spoken in secret. From the time it came to be, I have been here. And now, he who is God has sent me and his Spirit. So God is providing all this information ahead of time so that when it all happens, the people, Israel in particular, will be able to believe God's the only one. Verse 17, thus says he who is your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I am he who is your God, who teaches you to profit, who leads you in the way you should go. Oh, that you would have paid attention to my commandments, and then your peace would be like a river and your righteousness like waves of the sea. The poetic presentation here of righteousness being like weather patterns that are important to having life. So he wants their peace to be like a river, just always flowing. Their righteousness to be like the surf that's always coming up to the shore. Verse 19, your offspring would have been like the sand and your descendants like its grains. Your name would never be cut off or destroyed from before me. That's related to the promises made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, that their offspring would be like the sand on the seashore. Verse 20, go out from Babylon, flee from Chaldea, declare this with a shout of joy, proclaim it, send it in out to the end of the earth, say, he who is has redeemed his servant Jacob. When Cyrus gives the command, many tens of thousands of Israelis will leave places in Mesopotamia and travel to the Promised Land, the land either of their birth, if they're pretty old, or the land of their forefathers. And when they go, this will be the redemption that was promised, the return. Verse 20, they did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made water flow for them from the rock. He split the rock and the water gushed out. That's all references to the Exodus experience, bringing them out of Egypt and to the Promised Land through the wilderness. Well, God's going to bring them out of Babylon, out of Assyria, back to the Promised Land. Verse 22, there is no peace, says he who is, for the wicked. So God's going to be doing this for his righteous remnant to bring them back to the Promised Land. Chapter 49. Listen to me, O coastlands, and give attention, you peoples from afar. He who has called me from the womb, from the body of my mother, he named my name. He made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me a polished arrow. In his quiver, he hid me away. He said to me, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified. But I said, I've labored in vain. I've spent my strength for nothing in vanity. Yet surely my right is with he who is, and my recompense with my God. So now we get, again, kind of a poetic presentation that God has been working with Israel ever since the beginning of their existence as a nation. He's done great things for them because he's got great things planned for them. And they don't always understand that. Sometimes they think they're wasting their time and their effort. But God is going to bring the Messiah through this family and save the world. Verse 5, and now, he who is says, he who formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob to him, and that Israel might be gathered to him. For I am honored in the eyes of he who is, and my God has become my strength. He says, and by the way, this Isaiah also is kind of throwing his story in here, that God chose him to come at just this time to provide the prophecies that will be used in Israel's life. He says, this is what I know about God's witness, testimony. Verse 6, he says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as light for the nations that my salvation may reach the end of the earth. Now, all through this last section, we've got a mixture of prophecies about different times in Israeli history. And that includes the time of the comings of the Messiah. The coming the first time to be the atoning sacrifice for sin and to save us from our sins. And remember, Jesus' name in Hebrew, Yehoshua, means he who is salvation. And he's the light that's coming to the world that brings light not just to the Israelis, but to all the nations. And Israel is supposed to be the servant that takes that light to the nations. And we know that's how the church gets started. The ministry of the apostles and the spreading of the gospel from the Jewish core out into the world. That's all prophesied right here. Verse number 7, thus says he who is the Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to one deeply despised, abhorred by the nation, the servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise, princes, and they shall prostrate themselves because of he who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel, who has chosen you. And yes, it is true what the prophecy says here, that kings and princes will receive the gospel. And many of them will hand their lives over to God. And this will allow the gospel to spread farther and farther. Verse number 8, thus says he who is, in a time of favor, I've answered you. In a day of salvation, I've helped you. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people to establish the land, to apportion the desolate heritages, saying to the prisoners, come out! To those who are in darkness, appear! They shall feed along the way on all bare heights, shall be their pasture. They shall not hunger or thirst, neither scorching wind nor sun shall strike them. For he who has pity on them will lead them, and by springs of water will guide them. Now we jump ahead to what's going to happen with the second coming of Jesus, when he gathers his people to himself into the millennial kingdom, into the new heaven and new earth, in which there's righteousness and a restoration of what was originally intended in the creation. And so there won't be this scorching and heat and trouble. Verse number 11, and I will make all my mountains a road, and my highways shall be raised up. Behold, these shall come from afar, and behold, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Cyrene, which is probably somewhere down in Egypt, is what we're thinking. And so this is a gathering together. Now, some people think it's hinting at the gathering together for the people to come back to Israel as Israelis, to reestablish the kingdom, to reestablish everything that the Messiah is going to come to. And that's possible in some aspect here. But I think the bigger thing is for the ultimate gathering together, which will happen at the sounding of the trumpet, and the living and the dead in Christ shall be transformed and risen and caught up together to meet the Lord in the air, and then they will rule and reign with him, according to the book of Revelation, in Jerusalem. And so I think that's all being prophesied here in Isaiah. Verse 13, sing for joy, O heavens, and exult, O earth. Break forth, O mountains, into singing. For he who is has comforted his people and will have compassion on his afflicted. So everybody should be excited by this. Reminds me of chapter 19 in the book of Revelation. But Zion said, he who is has forsaken me. My Lord has forsaken me. Now that's the attitude, unfortunately, of many of the Israeli people, that God's just given up on them. And God's response is this. Can a woman forget her nursing child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. So God says, don't you dare think that I'm writing you off and forgetting you. I love this next verse. Behold, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands, and your walls are continually before me. So the poetry of the Old Testament is, I've written you down on the palms of my hands. But we know that Jesus himself took the scars of crucifixion right into his hands as the means of redeeming all of us to become the children of God. And so into eternity, our salvation is engraved on his hands in those scars.